Hello and welcome to Shattered Lives, Reach Ireland's crime podcast. I'm Paul Healy. I'm crime correspondent for the Irish Daily Star and the Irish Mirror, and I'm joined by Michael O'Toole, our crime and defence editor. How are you doing, Michael?
Hello, Paul. How's things?
Good. It's regrettably been a little bit of time since we've done our last pod, and I know that we promise our listeners to be somewhat regular with our weekly podcast, as we call it, and so we're going to strive to be a bit more consistent going forward. I know we've had a couple of people, and it's nice to have a couple of people message us and ask us, where have you gone? We haven't disappeared like Kate Middleton, for example. We haven't disappeared. We are just quite busy. And Michael, you were quite busy in particular. Obviously, you were initially a top secret mission, but it has come out now. You were with our defence forces, our wonderful defence forces out in Syria.
Yes. So I went to Camp Fawar, which is on the Bravo line. There's two lines in Syria at the Golan Heights where the defence forces are. Alpha line, which is sort of Israeli-held territory, Israeli-held Golan, Syrian territory. And then there's the Bravo line, which is the Syria area of control. So we were the first Western journalists to get on the Bravo line in 20 years. So we were there. The Irish are in Camp Faro, as I said, which is the headquarters of UNDOF, which is the United Nations Disengagement Observation Force, monitoring the ceasefire, the 40-year truce between Israel and Syria. So we've had a company-level contingent there since 2013. And the 68th Infantry Group are currently out there. They're back in a few weeks, actually. Their 6 months duty come to an end, and it's also the end of the large-scale mission. So there was myself, Niall O'Connor from the Journal, and Conor Gallagher from the Irish Times. Fantastic trip. A privilege as ever to go over and see the work the Defence Forces do. It's only when you go on these trips that you really see how really important and how vital it is. So we'll hopefully be doing... I brought some camera equipment and audiovisual equipment with me, so I was just talking to Andrew, the producer there. We'll be doing a pod from Syria. We interviewed quite a lot of soldiers, so it's going to be a collection of most of the soldiers that we interviewed. Lovely bunch of lads, I have to say. And you know what? It's very weird. I felt more relaxed in Syria, a war zone, than I have sometimes over here. It's just very, very weird.
Well, I mean, you're in your element there. I mean, you do love the defence aspect of the job and covering the defence forces. And it was great to read your pieces. And as you say, you have done a comprehensive pod on this, so we're not going to linger on it too much today. But I'd say it was, even for you, it was educational, you know, to be on the ground with them and to actually see what they do every day. And I mean, how they really do, I mean, I think they did tell you that they do worry every day about the possibility of, you know, losing their lives, about being put in danger, and it could happen at a moment's notice.
Yeah, Paul, and you've got to remember, they are the FRC, so the Force Reserve Company. And so they are, if it hits the fan, their job is to go and rescue. Oh, there's a contingent, it's the contingent, the UNDOF is about 1,100 soldiers all in, different nationalities, you know, Philippines, all that sort of stuff. So they are the insurance policy, the OC, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver Clear said, they're the insurance policy for the whole mission. So if something happens anywhere in the UNDOF area, they have to go and rescue soldiers. And they did. 2014, they had to rescue Philippine soldiers. There were other issues, you know. So it's real soldiering. And, you know, speaking privately to some of the soldiers, next door is obviously UNIFIL, United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, where we have 330 soldiers. And it's a different mission, where it's more, you're patrolling. It's a more slightly esoteric mission, because you have to go out and about, but you know, with the UNDOF, if it hits the fan, their job is to go there. So it's what they would consider much more soldiery sort of thing, and they would prefer UNDOF. Privately, they would say they prefer being in UNDOF than they would in UNIFIL. So I thought it was really, really interesting. So yeah, look, but it could happen anytime. In the blinking of an eye, there could be an incident, and it was really interesting. So they, as I say, they have to be the quick responders, and they have 15 minutes to get ready, to get tooled up, to get into their Moag armoured cars and go anywhere. So it really was high-stakes stuff.
It was fascinating. I can't wait to watch the full pod. And I know you've got some great equipment, and a lot of it was videoed. So it almost a documentary you filmed over there. So looking forward to seeing that. We've a lot to discuss in the pod today. We've been away for a bit, so I'm gonna fast forward a bit. So if people want to hear more about mixed travels in Syria, we will have a full pod on that. I'm going to briefly talk about Cork Prison because I was there yesterday, and we were brought. We were given great access by the Irish Prison Service into Cork Prison. It's not every day that you get inside a prison facility and you get to see what it is actually really like. And basically, the thought process behind this was to put up what they've called a pop-up kitchen, a pop-up restaurant. Inside Cork Prison. So that all happened last night, and several different business owners from the locality were invited into the prison and were given a full three-course meal cooked there by six prisoners who were chosen to put on the restaurant, the pop-up restaurant, as they called it. So they named it the Open Door pop-up restaurant. It looked like a lovely meal. We didn't stick around for the meal ourselves, but we were granted great access into the kitchens and saw the lads putting together the meal. And you know, the prisoners that we did meet do seem to want to turn their lives around. They're in for, I suppose, what you'd call relatively minor offences. They're in for, most of them are in for possession of drugs and serving about 18 months or 2 years. So two lads we spoke to were serving about that amount of time. Couldn't identify them, but we were able to interview them and just get an insight into their life in there. And they both said that by working in the kitchens, they get an unprecedented amount of freedom. And when they went into prison, they didn't expect that they would be doing anything other than sitting behind a cell door 24 hours a day. So they actually spend most of their time in the kitchens, and they've been learning under the tutorship of JJ Healy there. He's an MTU lecturer and chef himself, and they have become, you know, their goal is to become chefs when they get out. They have become fully fledged chefs, and now they're hoping maybe when they impressed with their skills last night that they will gain employment when they get out. And so we learned that there are quite a number of employers within the locality who are surprisingly open to employing these prisoners when they get out.
And I think this goes to the heart of it. Prison, I remember a judge in a high profile case said, you know, there has to be an element of punishment in people going to prison, but it's also about rehabilitation. And some people might not want to hear that, but you know, very few prisoners stay in prison their whole lives, so at some stage they will come out. So do you want them coming out of prison in a worse place than they were when they went in, or do you want them coming out in a better place?
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, the message that came across, you know, yesterday was, you don't have to do any of this. You can go into prison and you can be, you know, you can just not work with the system, and it'll get you nowhere. But they offer great opportunities for you to rehabilitate yourself, to gain education in various different fields, so that when you get out, the hope is that they have educated enough that they don't want to see you come back in, you know. And it's a process that clearly works. I mean, we met a former prisoner. He came in for the day. Must have been surreal for him to come back to prison, let alone be interviewed by us. But he was in for possession of drugs. He served 2 years. He's now a fully fledged chef, and he's employed and he's doing well. So it does work, as long as they are willing to, you know, work with the system. And we didn't just meet prisoners who worked in the kitchens. We also saw, you know, prisoners engaged in a ECDL computer course. They're in arts classes, some incredible artwork, like really, which we saw one drawing and a painting done supposedly by a prisoner who'd never painted before in his life. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, you could hang it in a gallery. So they learn new skills there, or they realize that they have skills that they never, you know, thought to explore before. So you could look at that cynically and say, oh, like, you know, they're having a great comfortable time in there. But the goal of it is, you know, to educate these people and give them maybe an opportunity to not return to prison. And that is the ultimate goal, because otherwise it's just a repeated cycle. And certainly our prisons are completely overpopulated. So, yeah, it was great to see a positive light maybe on the prison system, rather than all the negative stories that we certainly hear about.
And just let me ask you, Paul, that wasn't your first time to enter a prison, was it?
No, I was in the same prison, I think last year, Cork Prison as well, yeah. So I have not been in some of the Dublin jails. I'd be very interested to get into Mountjoy or Weedfield, for example. We've heard plenty of negative stories about drugs and contraband getting in. It would be fascinating to see the processes that they've put in to try and prevent all of that. So maybe we'll get to do that someday.
So I've been in the Midlands in Portlaoise. I've been in Wakefield, and I've been in a prison in Alicante in Spain.
Wow.
What did you what do you make of what did you have any emotions when you were in the prison?
Emotions? That's an interesting question.
Mm.
There's a the Jeremy Paxman in you now, huh? I don't know if it's an emotion, but I was surprised, I suppose, because we got a lot more access than we did previously. So we saw, you know, the various different classes that are put on and the jobs that they are given and all of the things that they are afforded surprised me. I mean, I know that our prisons are not, you know, maximum security facilities where people are in solitary confinement 24/7, but I was surprised at the level of freedom that they have once they work with the system. So, but, you know, you could see even in the lads that we interviewed, as much as they were afforded opportunities, they still were very much aware of, you know, they're in here for, they would rather not be in there. And their freedom had been taken from them. And you could see the upset that that had caused them. Definitely the two lads that we got to interview, I saw a lot of regret in them. And even though they were, you know, talking positive about working in the kitchens, they both sort of had a weariness about them that was it was amazing to see, because you saw that they really didn't want to be there ultimately, and so that was interesting, yeah, and gave me some hope actually that rehabilitation is possible.
The reason why I'm asking is, you met all these stories we've done. We broke this in the first place about prisoners getting PlayStations maybe 10, 15 years ago. I make no excuses. Stand over that story. It was a good story. But when I went into prison those times, it made me realise, let them have TVs, let them have PlayStations, whatever. Let them have radios. It's no problem, because they are in there and their liberty is taken from them. You are in a small cell. Okay, you're on the landing, but your liberty... liberty is precious, and it's taken from you because you've committed crimes. So it sort of changed my attitude about let them have whatever they want, because the most precious thing they can have, without sounding all, are, you know, is their freedom, and their freedom is taken from them, self-inflicted. So it sort of changed my view. Those doors close and that's it, and you're gone. So I would have a strong belief of give them whatever they want within reasons, because it's their liberty that's taken from them. And it sort of gives me the heebie-jeebies, I have to say, whenever I go into prison, just those doors closing. And even when I went to Kilmainham Jail, the old Kilmainham Jail, the Breakers Yard, where James Connolly and the other martyrs were executed, looking up, I can remember looking up, and the wall was huge, and I was going, geez, imagine being here, and there's no escape, there's no hope for you. So it does affect me whenever I go into prison.
Yeah, I suppose it was scary, you know, thinking about, Jesus, imagine if you did end up in here, yeah. Having said that, yeah, but yesterday we were shown the positives of you know, of prison. We didn't see the negatives, per se. But I did see in those two lads we interviewed that really, you know, they would rather have not been there. And I saw some humility in them, and maybe shame even in their past actions. So, yeah.
Yeah, look, a lot of prisoners, most prisoners, I would say, have just taken the wrong road or gone down the wrong road in life. There are some sociopaths and psychopaths, but the vast majority of people, it is bad decisions. So they're in a hole, and to be fair to those lads, they seem to be trying to, they've stopped digging and they're trying to get themselves out of the hole. So I wish them all the best and hope it works for them.
Yeah, it's good to see. There's some hope, some light at the end of the tunnel for some of these people, and they're in for very short sentences, the people that we met, you know, so they still have a life to look forward to, you know.
But there'd be one man, speaking of prison, who, if he does go to prison, he'll be in for a long time, and that's Daniel Kinahan.
So this is the big story.
A breakthrough. Yeah. So it's remarkable how these things come about. Sean McCurry, a freelance reporter, did a story about the inquest for Eddie Hutch, who our listeners will know. Eddie, who's the 58-year-old brother of Jerry Hutch, was murdered in the end of February 2016, three days after the Regency, in which David Byrne was murdered. He was the first person to be murdered by the Kinahan gang in retaliation for that, I suppose. And then, you know, we know that there are 18 people murdered altogether. But his inquest was on I think it was Monday. And Aidan Flanagan, a detective inspector in Store Street, Mountjoy area, said that basically that there are three persons of interest who have fled, left the jurisdiction, and that a number of a file has gone to the Director of Public Prosecutions. So I was reading that copy and I went, oh, that's interesting. Because you and I know, Paul, when a file goes to the DPP, it contains usually contains recommendations. So I did a bit of digging and we did establish that there was a recommendation that a number of people be charged, I think about 10, with various roles in that, and one of them is Daniel Kinnan. So we got that story, basically, that so essentially a file has been sent to the DPP asking for Daniel Kinnan to be charged with the murder of Eddie
Hatch. Yeah, now the significance of that is huge because, I mean, to be fair, you actually did previously, from my recollection, break the story that Gardaí wanted to charge Daniel Kinnan in relation to the murder of Eddie Hutch. But it's one thing to investigate that and to ultimately want that, but now that the file has been sent to the DPP, they're saying, we are happy to charge him. We want to charge Daniel Kinnahan with murder. And now the DPP has, I suppose they can have up to the end of the year to, what is the time limit?
I think it's a movable feast. There was someone who was investigated for rape. You remember, the person that I'm talking about. And the guard sent the file there, and I think it was about 6 months. So it could be 6 months, could be a year. But we're talking about that now. With Kinnahan, it's a big file. We know that Kinnahan has been investigated for directing a crime gang, which is a huge file. Now, that file hasn't gone, but it's being prepared. So I think the guard investigation phase has ended, and they're at the preparation of the file phase, which can be a long one. And you'll also remember the plot to kill a man called Michael Gately, James Gately, in May in 2017. Imre Rakas was done for that. He's been done and he's left the country already. We know that Gardaí have evidence in their mind that Daniel Kinnahan was involved in orchestrating that murder bit. So there's a separate investigation. So that's three serious investigations in which Daniel Kinnahan is the focus, because essentially there's a photograph, a screen grab of a message on Imbaracris's burner phone when it said, killed Michael Gately. And the allegation is that that was sent on an encrochat phone from Daniel Kinnahan in Dubai. So three investigations. So they've got three chances of getting him. But if a file has gone to the DPP with a recommendation, you're right, Paul, that's basically the guard saying, we believe there is enough evidence to sustain a conviction against Daniel Kinnahan. Now, they advise, the DPP decides. So it's the DPP's decision, not the guards. The guards bring it to a certain level, then it's the DPP who decides. But just talking to people, I think there would be a level of confidence that the Gardaí believe they have enough evidence for him to be charged. Now, that's not convicted. It's charged. Who knows?
Well, that's huge. Now, we hope that maybe lessons have been learned. It is an entirely different investigation to the Regency one, obviously. But as people will remember, they went after Jerry the Monk Hutch on that single charge of murder. And the case really didn't contain, I think it's fair to say, did not contain any evidence that he committed the murder. The judges of that court said that there was possibly evidence of other offences that might have been committed, maybe firearms. But that wasn't the charge he was there to meet. With Daniel Kinnahan, we don't have access to the whole file. We maybe only know 10% of the information, but I think from our understanding of it and what's being reported is Daniel Kinnahan didn't pull the trigger. They don't believe that, but Daniel Kinnahan played a central role in the murder of Eddie Hutch. It happened only 3 days after the murder of David Byrne at the Regency Hotel. And I think the Kinnahans were really gunning for revenge as quickly as possible. And it seems as if Daniel Kinnahan was still in the country and that he was on the scene or very close to the scene. And I think if I'm right, they can place him near to the scene and to the individuals that they believe carried out that particular murder.
Yeah, and you raise a very valid point. You know, you covered the trial, Paul. Miss Justice Tara Burns effectively demolished the state's case against Jerry Hutch, and he was vindicated and he was acquitted. So I wonder, will that be preying on the minds of the DPP and the Garda prosecutor, the Gardaí who are involved in this? So look, I mean, you know, it's once bitten, twice shy. So I think they'll have to have all their ducks in a row. And I think the DPP will be very careful and will examine the evidence. So I think if there is a charge, it would have to be based on the basis of much more confidence in the case than they did have, say, perhaps with Mr. Hutch. So we'll watch this space. But look, the other elephant in the room is Daniel Kinnan is not in Ireland.
No, I mean, this is so complicated. But even Daniel Kinnan, take him aside for a minute, there are two other individuals that are outside of the country that they believe were involved. One of them, I think, was last seen in Spain, is an associate of Marlo Hyland. And the other individual as well is out of the jurisdiction. And I think there is another individual, or you might tell me I'm getting confused, who is serving a sentence for something else, who is also a suspect. The Gardaí have strong suspicions as to who carried out the murder of Eddie Hutch and who was involved in the peripheries of it. I think this is possibly the only one where it's suspected that Daniel Kinahan directly got his hands dirty. Not, as I said, didn't pull the trigger, but was certainly within the vicinity of the scene and involved with the persons who carried it out in and around the same night, same evening. Mm-hmm. So he was possibly quite reckless on that night. We might find out that, you know, at that point in time, the Kinahans were gunning for revenge. You remember Mick O'Neill's picture, which we reproduced and has been everywhere since, of Daniel Kinahan and Bomber Kavanagh seemingly conspiring together in a car park the day after, or maybe it was 2 days after, the Regency Hotel.
No, it was the Saturday
murder. Okay, so the day after. You know, and we know the Kinahans basically had a crisis summit and were gunning for revenge. It didn't take them long. They went after a soft target. They went after Jerry Hutch's brother, killed him there at his home in Poplar Row. But it seems Daniel Kinahan, ultimately the very first murder of the feud, might be the one that he first gets charged over and might be the one that finally gets him back into a court here in Ireland.
Yes, the blood was up. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. It was real. You know, looking back, it was a frenetic time. It was a frenetic time for Gardaí policing this. Mm. It was a frenetic time for us. Not that that matters, reporting on it. And I have no doubt it was a frenetic time for the Kinahan cartel, because just remember, this is context, not defend him, but the context was Daniel Kinahan came within seconds of being murdered himself at the Regency.
Yes.
We know he was the target. We know that somebody threw a bottle at the gang and got Daniel Kinahan out of the way. So I'm sure, I'm not, you know, let's say it's understand. You know, let's say it would be entirely but credible that his blood was up and he was taking this personal. And, you know, obviously there were events afterwards and he got out of the country. But yeah, I think that the cartel themselves, the leadership, were really focused and invested in getting retaliation very quickly.
Well, that's the thing, and it shows that his sloppiness might be what is his downfall, because, you know, the murders that happened subsequently, he was hands off, you know, and they became much more complex in nature, and the individuals involved were less and less known to the Gardaí. People, the murder for hire type stuff, they were getting their hands dirty with some of their most senior members early on, and it seems that Daniel Kinahan himself was centrally involved in it. So yeah, we'll see whether it ultimately gets him extradited, but we're a long way away from that still.
And look, I know there are, you're right, Paul, there are lots of hurdles, but just to give credit to the guards in the North Central, you know, they have done really fantastic work. And if they can get 10 people, if it is, I think it is about 10, could be more, could be 12. If they can get 10 people, 12 people charged and convicted over the murder of Eddie Hutch, that's fantastic policing from their perspective. You know, they've really done, because it was Trojan work. Like, I know with one murder, they had to bring in guards. It was Mountjoy District with one murder, and there were so many murders around the time, they had to hand one murder over to the Bridewell District just because there were just so many. But if they get 12, 10 or 12 people charged and convicted, that would be real Trojan work on their part.
Huge.
They have been very successful.
You know, it's much needed after the Regency trial to have a success on that level. And I know they want to get it right. They really do. And you can see that the management of An Garda Síochána Conor are very much pushing for this. They want this will be, if it happens, certainly Drew Harris, if he's still Garda Commissioner, You know, it'll be his crowning achievement. Not that it's all Drew Harris's work, but certainly Assistant Commissioner Justin Kelly and all the senior members of Garda Síochána want this to happen. And you can see that in the fact that Drew Harris was in Dubai only last week. Now, I know there was a global summit of police chiefs from all over the world, but he gave a very significant speech himself where he actually said that he was embarrassed that the Kinahan cartel had grown to the size that it had and was worth over €1 billion, and very much pointed the finger and said, well, now we're coming for you. He was there in Dubai, the very city that they are still in, as far as we know, and saying again, this is for the second time in a couple of months, we're coming for you.
And there's a legal precept that barristers don't ask questions that they don't know the answer to. So in other words, when they're asking somebody a question in the stand, they know what the answer is because they don't want any surprises. So I'm going to sort of transfer that over to policing. Would the commissioner be saying that sort of thing if he didn't have a level of confidence that it was going to work out? In other words, would he not be making a fool of himself if he was doing all this without knowing that there's a very good chance that they're going to get Kinahan?
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I'm going with it. There seems to be a degree of confidence, yeah. And I mean, now look at the timing. We've learned that 2 weeks ago they sent the file to the director to charge Daniel Kinahan, and he was over there in Dubai then making that speech. So when he was making that speech, he knew we've sent the file off. We're going to charge him with murder, or we hope to charge him with murder.
Right. So going 10 steps forward, would it be fair to say that if they did bring Daniel Kinahan home, and he was, first, if he was extradited and he was kicked out and he was, the decision was made by the TPP to charge him and he comes back and he goes on trial, do you think it'll be in the special?
Oh, 100% it'll be in the special.
No doubt.
There's not a jury in the land that they'll be able to say that it's a fair trial. I mean, look, no doubt if they extradite him, Kinahan will challenge that the same way that Hutch did, Jerry Hutch did. You know, they don't want it to be heard in the Special Criminal Court because they believe they won't get a fair trial there, and they think that no jury will ever be able to convict them because of everything that's been written in the papers. But that's not true. We've already seen that the Special Criminal Court works. You know, Jerry Hutch was acquitted and other people have been convicted based off the evidence. I think some people would nearly rather be tried by a special criminal court judge than jury these days, you know. So,
is it fair to say that the Hutch trial was the biggest trial in the special criminal court since probably John Gilligan?
Well, yeah. Well, it's the biggest trial I've ever covered. Mm. I wasn't around for Gilligan in the special.
I was. So there was Mickey McKevitt as well. I think the Hutch trial was humongous and massive. And Miss Justice Tara Burns said, no, not having it. And she's one of the two presiding judges. There are two special criminal courts. It's herself and Mr. Justice Tony Hunt. And I think Miss Justice Tara Burns. And I'd say Mr. Justice Tony Hunt would be the same. Go, not happening. Need the level of proof. And it wasn't there.
Well, like Kinahan will be on another level. If you remember the armed guards outside the courts every day, I think it'll be that times 10. It'll be easily the biggest trial that this country has ever seen. I still don't quite believe that it's going to happen, even though the guards are saying we're ready to charge him. There's so many steps. You know, now we have our government minister for justice, Helen McEntee, is attempting to negotiate some sort of extradition treaty with the United Arab Emirates, but it's a difficult country. It's a corrupt country. I'm not saying the government are directly corrupt, but there's a lot of corruption going on, a lot of wheeling and dealing going on, a lot of protecting of criminals. Not to mention that Kinahan probably has the resources, or we would have thought had the resources to get out of there if they came gunning for him. There's a lot of hurdles to cross before they ever get to extradite him back here. It's hard to imagine that it could possibly happen. But wouldn't it be extraordinary if it did?
I think one day you and I'll be sitting here going, Jesus Christ, it's dead. And somebody will ring us and it'll be, get to the special, or get the Baldonnelly's on his way in. And it'll be, holy shit.
Yeah, well, I mean.
No, there is. There is one thing that I think that would give Gardaí hope and the department here. And that's Raffaele Imperiale, who was, we know, yes, he was one of Kinahan's pals. He was at his lavish wedding in 2017 in Dubai. He's over in Italy. It's exactly the same EU. So he was kicked out, sent to Italy from Dubai. and he's a pentito, as we say. He's, you know, singing like a canary over there. So if it happened to him, what's to stop it happening to Daniel Kinahan?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, he's the prime example. You know, so they did kick him out. So that's going in the right direction. That's certainly showing that they are willing to kick these criminals out of their country. We'll see what happens. Watch this space.
Right, what are we going to talk about next?
Yes, we want to talk about this controversy with the suspended Garda and the bike. An extraordinary story. I mean, surreal. It's Father Ted stuff. But look, that poor Garda. Just in case anybody hasn't been following the story, a Garda in the Midlands was suspended from duty after effectively giving a bike that they had, an unclaimed bike that was in their storage in the Garda station, gave it to this elderly man during COVID in 2020, in the pandemic, when this elderly gentleman didn't have the ability to go out and buy a bicycle. So the kind community Garda gave the bicycle to this person, who I understand he would have known locally, and thought he was doing him a favour, but didn't do the relevant paperwork, is the official line of things. And as a result of that, he was ultimately suspended from duty and spent 3 years suspended. And then there was a disciplinary process. He went back to duty in August of last year, and the disciplinary process effectively cleared him last week. And now it's up to the commissioner, effectively, to have a look at that. But I think what Garda headquarters would say is the process is complete, the disciplinary process has cleared him, and all routes seem to be this Garda is going to go back to duty. I doubt very much that the Garda commissioner is going to step in and take any role in this.
There is one important clarification about this. That Garda headquarters, to be fair, did clarify this. It's a board of inquiry. So once the board of inquiry doesn't offer any sanction, so in other words, once the board of inquiry clears a member, that's it. There is a 3-week period, but the Garda commissioner can't do anything. If the board of inquiry says, right, we're going to sanction him with a week's pay cut, the commissioner can go, no, I want to do X, I want to sack him or whatever. But it's dead. It's effectively dead now. There's nothing the commissioner can do. There's a 3-week period, but that's really it. So I think it's important to clarify that. So it is effectively over for the Garda. But let's be clear, there was a criminal investigation into this as well as a disciplinary matter. So the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation were brought in. I know why they were brought in. It's no reflection on the Guard. I think it was just a local issue that I think it was decided it's best if the NBCI come in and do this, but it was no reflection on the Guard or anybody else. It was just a technical thing, shall we say. But, you know, the file went to DPP. The DPP said, "And I'm not having it. There's no criminality here. That Guard, his name is clear." But the internal disciplinary thing went on for quite some time. So, but it is important to stress, the Board of Inquiry cleared him. He was exonerated at last for several days. The Board exonerated him. So Shane A., the Garda commissioner can't do anything, and it's important to clarify that.
That is important to clarify, because there is a bit of a narrative out there that he would possibly be able to step in and do something about it. But I just thought, even from a saving face point of view, he would be nuts to get involved now and overturn things. But obviously you're saying he cannot do that. So that's good news.
And even after covering the Guards for 20, 30 years, one thing I've learned from this, you know, it's looking at the whole way. I think once it went on paper, there was nothing anybody could do. In other words, no senior officer could go, no, this is a pile of shit. Because I think they can't be seen to be sort of interfering in an investigation. It's unfortunate. It really, really is unfortunate. And looking from the outside, you would think that some senior officer could have gone, this is a load of nonsense. What are we doing here? But I think that at every stage of the way, their hands were tied, because it's on paper. And, you know, maybe it goes back just in a parallel to the whole penalty points thing. You know, Guards cannot be seen to be interfering. So every guard at every stage said, no, I'm not I can't do this. So they have to do their bit. Do you know what I'm trying to say? That it's unfortunate, but the wheel started and nobody could stop the wheel spinning until
that's
it reached
the process.
The end. Exactly.
It's bananas, though, isn't it? Because nearly everybody involved in the process probably thought this is a ridiculous, complete waste of time. This poor Garda, he's suspended. You know, it affects his livelihood, his mental health, everything. It's an embarrassment, really. But yet, nobody can do anything about it because they have to follow the procedure. So, look, maybe the procedure needs to be looked at.
That's probably a million percent
what the Garda Representative Association are arguing for, you know, because this happens across the board. Guards are suspended for a myriad of silly reasons. There are guards genuinely suspended under serious investigation, but there's been a lot of Mickey Mouse stuff, and it's really dragging, this is what the GRA would say, it's dragging down the reputation of Gardaí. It's putting people off wanting to work in the force. People who are already in the force are leaving because of just the culture in there and the fear that comes with being investigated, being suspended for Mickey Mouse stuff. And let's face it, this was Mickey Mouse. And I went down to the, I just want to mention, I went down to that locality. I'm not going to say where it is because I don't identify the Garda. But everyone in his locality knows who he is and says he's a great guy, genuine community guard, really well respected and well liked by everyone. And everyone just feels really sorry for him. But I think there's a feeling of, and I wouldn't blame this Garda if he goes back to his full duties and he says, well, hump this, I'm leaving. Because he's done 3 decades in an Garda Síochána and he's been insulted and embarrassed at the end. And you know, maybe he, and I can't speak for him, but I wouldn't blame him if he ultimately said, I'm done.
Or if he took a case.
Or if he took a case, yeah.
Lots of guards are saying to me he should sue. I don't know what it, you know, it's not up to me, it's not up to you. I'm only saying what guards are telling me, that they go, I hope he takes them to the cleaners. But yeah, it's very unfortunate. And you know what? Who'd be sitting there? Imagine if you're the commissioner and you're dealing with matters of state security and you're dealing with life and death every day and suddenly it's a bloody bike. How crazy is that?
But nonetheless, he you know, the commissioner has been targeted in this, I think, probably for the overall issue of just that culture within an Garda Síochána, which the GRA and other members would blame him for being responsible for. And I don't know whether this is the straw that breaks the camel's back, but it has certainly increased the tensions again between ordinary members and the commissioner himself. And I know that he's not invited to the annual conference of the GRA later this year. You know, so is his job still in trouble?
I don't know, but I'm boycotting it in solidarity with him. I'm going to actually, you're doing the GRA.
The GRA is great crack altogether, and it's always very interesting. But I think it's unprecedented that a commissioner would not be invited.
It has never happened. And look, it was a decision taken by, to be serious for a second, it was a decision taken by the CEC. It happened, you know, we haven't done one for a while for various reasons, but maybe we should talk about this. I do know it wasn't unanimous. There were some abstentions, and a small number of abstentions, I think, and a small number of people weren't there. But look, it wasn't unanimous. And some guards will say they think it was a mistake because it sort of puts them in the back foot and gives a lot of sympathy nationwide to the commissioner. Other guards will say it was great, and they think, look, how can we invite him to the conference if we don't have any faith in him? So I understand, but some guards didn't like that. Some guards did.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's various different people with different personalities in an Garda Síochána. They don't all speak with one voice, certainly to see a vast majority of them disinvite him or not invite him, agree to not invite him, it is an unprecedented step. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, and no, he is definitely the first commissioner not to be invited. There were various things with, you know, ministers and all, a bit of brouhaha, but this is the first commissioner, so it's a heavy move. But you know what? Having a vote of no confidence is a heavy move as well. You're quite right.
Yeah, I think we'll leave it there because we've been actually speaking for over 40 minutes. Are there something you want to mention?
I just want to mention the great Charlie Byrd.
Of course.
He's my general. I think he probably left the game by the time you really got really involved in this, Paul. But I think any journalist my age and older will realise how important Charlie Byrd was in journalism. He was just fantastic. He was a whirlwind. Now, I know that I can be a bollocks when I'm on a job. I know that I get very single-minded and I can be rude and direct and say, I don't give two flying shites. We're doing this and, you know, I wouldn't be particularly worried about how my photographer colleague or how colleagues with me might feel about me saying, I'm doing this. And I want to say that all came down to Charlie Bird, because I learned that from him. I tweeted about this. I was in Liberia with him for a week, and I thought for a week, I was going, who is this bollocks? Because he just didn't stop. And he was quite, you know, demanding and quite, I'm doing this, right? And then he stopped and he became a gentleman. He was just brilliant. And I learned from him in that week, you do your job, you do it to the utmost of your ability, you let nothing get in your way, you don't listen to your colleagues when they're moaning, you do your fucking job, right? And that was because of Charlie. So thank you, Charlie, for improving my career massively 20 years ago.
He was a true veteran in the industry. I grew up watching Charlie Bird, like, and he was the epitome of a journalist. I mean, he did everything. He was all over the world. He tracked down David Drum. I remember that.
Central, you know, to the IRA, central to the peace process.
Yeah, he was incredibly inspiring. And even when he left, you know, the industry, you know, and then he battled motor neuron disease, I mean, he continued to speak out and raised an awful lot of money, millions, you know, to support the research of that disease. So a genuine hero and someone we can all look up to.
R.I.P. Charlie. And just very, very briefly, I remember sitting there one day, it was a quiet day, and suddenly he is on TV interviewing James Monaghan, one of the Columbia Three, who had, the three of them had left Columbia. And I was going, how the fuck did he get that? But that was Charlie. Charlie constantly amazed us with, how does he get these stories? So I owe Charlie a lot. Just from that week, I think he changed my career. I realised what you needed to be a certain level of a journalist. So it's down to him. So I just, God bless him and thanks.
So we'll leave it there. Thank you for listening to us as always. Sorry that we haven't been very consistent, but our aim now is to do this podcast and to have it out with you every Thursday. And if it isn't every Thursday, call us out on it. But our goal is to have it out every week, a weekly podcast for you. So thanks very much to everyone who's continuing to listen to us, and we'll see you next week.
And we do enjoy it. You've just broken up there, Paul. We do enjoy it, so hopefully you can hear me. So, oh, there you are there. I just want to say, I really enjoy it. I think it's fantastic. We really would enjoy it. It's on top of our normal work. I know I'm owning many, but you know, that's sometimes why we can't get to do it, because Paul is running around the country and I'm having to deal with, you know, God knows what, things in the background. So it's a labour of love, and we're going to do more.